Our next session is with Kirk Harnack. He's with the Telos Alliance. He's the Senior Solutions Consultant. I had to ask for the card to make sure to get the official title in there. Kirk and I have worked together a long time in different things and projects and such like that. His presentation is
Faster, Cheaper, Better.
Faster, Cheaper, Better. I couldn't remember that. Sorry. In there. So I want to introduce Kirk and have everybody's attention for his session now. Thank you. What?
You know, 40 years ago, you would have expected me to do that up here. 40 years ago, a third of you would be puffing away right now. Yeah, these days the cigarette has changed, hasn't it? I've never smoked. I've smoked some cigars and tried to smoke a pipe and pretty well choked on that. But what was okay 40 years ago is really not okay anymore, is it? Or it's okay in a different way. So what are you doing now that maybe's not really okay? What are you doing now that was great 40 years ago? Maybe when you got into this business, like I did 40 years ago. Well, we're going to talk about that and talk about, there we go. A couple of these slides, the font went off the top, so. Hey, is there a chance I can get the video here or not? Oh, maybe it's not turned on.
It shut itself off.
It shut itself off. All right. We'll see what happens.
Maybe so.
Yeah. All right, let me double check.
Okay. We're going to be talking about disruptive technologies and then how you can put those to work. And at the Telos Alliance, you know, Steve Church was pretty well involved with some disruptive technologies, right? Steve put the first DSP chip that we know of in a broadcast piece of equipment, and that would be the Telos 10 hybrid. And that was kind of disruptive. Nobody ever thought to use digital signal processing on a phone call. And then Steve was the first guy to think, hey, we could take ISDN phone lines. You combine two B channels, you get 128 kilobits. MP3 works pretty good at 128 kilobits. Maybe we could marry those two things. And then around 1999, the thought was, I wonder if we could use a computer network to carry audio, but do it in real time with very low latency. And whenever you come up with disruptive technologies, there are always people, oftentimes in your own organization, who will say, that won't work. Or maybe a competing organization that will say, well, that works, but you don't want that. And then you find competing organizations that say, oh yeah, that works, and we do that too. Find a lot of that. And being at the forefront, you take a lot of arrows, right? I did an SBE meeting in New York City back in about 2004, and was showing, I brought some Axia audio over IP gear. We had a little HP switch and a smart surface and a couple of nodes, and we showed audio back and forth. And I had a Windows computer running the IP driver, and it obviously worked. And at the end of the SBE meeting, or the Q&A time, a guy in the back raised his hand and said, that won't work. And now, I think about 3 years ago, AES-67, all the manufacturers had all their AES-67 working, and you went to the NAB show, and I stood in the Telos booth, and I looked around the NAB show, and every booth I could see said AES-67. As in, yeah, of course we do that. We do that too. Well, that's part of being disruptive. Another part of being disruptive is overcoming. Now, I deign to put myself in this picture here just because of a small story or just a small factoid. So we have a king, some actors, singers, former CEO of General Motors, prime minister, crazy guy that runs Virgin Atlantic and everything else like that. What did all these people overcome to get somewhere? Every person pictured here overcame stuttering. Every one of them had a hard time saying their name. And look where they are now. I mean, I read audiobooks and do weather on TV sometimes when they let me. But overcoming challenges is a very interesting process. And it's something that I think we should embrace, and we should be cheerleaders for people who are overcoming, whether it's in their personal life or whether it's technology, that we're trying to make something work better. So this picture was taken in the early 1990s in France. I just happened to have a picture of me in France in front of some equipment. And you'll notice something about every piece of equipment in those racks. Every piece of equipment there is purpose-built. I talked about this last year with Alex Hartman here on the stage, that we went from purpose-built equipment for decades and more purpose-built equipment. I mean, that reel-to-reel tape machine from Otari is not going to, well, it's not going to do your audio processing. And it's not going to be your remote control. And the, you know, the turntable is not going to be your EAS system. Can't. It was built to do one thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you can't put new firmware. You can't upgrade the turntable. Well, I guess you can put new felt on the turntable. And we did that. How many did that? Put new felt on the turntable. Absolutely. Put new heads in the cart machine or the Otari. You could put new firmware in the Orban processor. I guess that's an exception. And the Sage. How many you got to pay for the Sage upgrade? So, you know, the Orban is, well, it's got a microprocessor in it and DSP chips, and the Sage is built on a computer. So, yeah, I guess they are upgradable. Maybe that's not not the best example that I meant to get the word across. We built studios like this, right, with purpose-built equipment, and everything had a purpose in it. And we like that in our minds. That works well in our head. I'm going to put this right here, and I'm going to put this right here, and it's going to do these things, and that's great. But it does make flexibility almost impossible. We really can't do much of anything else. Even a modern studio, and this is just gorgeous. I think this is in Dubai. But even in that studio, most things do what they were designed to do. I guess the audio console, it's an Axia console, obviously, but it's running software, and so you can upgrade it and make it do somewhat different things. But still, the control surface is meant, you know, with faders and buttons. How many of you ran a DCS? It was great. You know, it worked almost as well as purpose-built equipment. In some ways, probably better. But this was an early example of virtualization. What were we virtualizing? We were virtualizing cart machines with this. And did you have one that connected to the Sony jukeboxes? And you had to have three Sony jukeboxes, and when one of them died, your record library suddenly went down to two-thirds of what it was, and you couldn't schedule things back? Oh, and then, you know, scheduling became a nightmare. More virtualization today looks kind of like this. We can obviously virtualize an audio console, or at least its control surface, on a touchscreen, on a multi-touch touchscreen. And touchscreens have gotten better to the point where, you know, as Alex pointed out last year, we're not designing touchscreens and touchscreen controls for guys like me who are getting close to 60. This is for the 20-somethings who are running air shifts now on some stations, or being the creatives now. Same thing with that tablet there. There's nothing to grab and hold and feel, but you know what the kids are doing these days? they grab the bezel, the side of the screen, and they know how far it is to the fader. They don't really have to look at it. And if it's well designed and with the buttons not too close together, it can be pretty effective. And there's lots more you can do, you know, with virtual buttons, virtual panels that control phone callers, virtual panel that even can have your traffic cameras in it, or your whatever tweets are happening about your station or your show. We can do all that. Hey, in the upper left-hand corner there's an example of Cumulus wanted to do a Radio Row deal, and the Dickies sent Gary Klein to see me and asked to borrow 30 consoles. And we said, no, we can't really loan you 30 consoles. Be glad to sell them to you. Gary said, no, Dickies aren't going to do that. So we figured out, hey, you know what? We can take our mix engines, and every mix engine has 16 five-fader consoles built into it that you never see, but you can use them as utility mixers. And so Cumulus's company, BSI, wrote the software that runs on an iPad that lets you control that mixer. And then with really strong Wi-Fi, they made all that work. And they've been using it. They've made a few changes in it since, but it uses the same underlying technology. So they virtualized 30 radio consoles. Maybe you've seen this graphic before, where if you take all those products in a Radio Shack ad, I don't know where you get a $200 iPhone. I'm not sure who wrote that, and I never took the time to fix that in the graphic. But virtualization can get you some pretty interesting things. How many of you do any ham radio stuff on your phone? Connect to IRLP or whatever? Yeah. Look where the band openings are on maps. See where the lightning is. Know whether to crank your mast down or not. So there's a lot of cool things that we can do by virtualizing. Well, one of the cool things that we can do by virtualizing is to make our studios better. And so here's a couple friends of the industry, Scott Shannon and Andrew Jeffries, and they've got something to say about this. You want me to roll it? Okay. If you can roll it, that'd be great.
One thing is still the same year after year. It's about the individual behind the microphone being able to communicate with the people who are listening online, on their phone, in their car, on their radio.
So we asked the question of a major European broadcaster of what would the talent in the studio really like the future of their technology, the future of their studios to look like. And the answer that came back was not what we or the broadcaster was expecting. But there were two clear things they wanted. One was cushions and the other was daylight. Hi, my name is Dan McQuillan from Broadcast Bionics, and today we want to talk about the Bionic Studio. That's the future of radio production, fitting it to reach and retain an audience of distracted listeners, and also helping you to measure and monetize all of those different platforms that radio now needs to reach. So a Bionic Studio means a studio which is listening and watching and reacting to what's happened. So rather than the technology merely being passive, it's part of the production. I mean, if you think about it, you wouldn't hire a producer and then sit them down the hall and have them not listen to the program. They couldn't be much help, but that's basically how the technology has been. It's been passively inert in the studio. But now through intelligent and fast transcription, the studio can react. It can understand what you're saying and automatically detect topics or segment your program. Using face detection, we can recognize who's speaking on cameras to help to generate the metadata that lets us drive more intelligent programming. So a Bionic Studio looks and works in terms of your operation exactly the same as a passive one, but the tools that you're using are able to react in context. You play a particular song, we can react to that song by pulling more information and control into the studio. It's about capturing the very best moments of radio, those intimate moments when the voice breaks and you know a caller's going to cry, when you have something that just has that driveway moment, when you can't exit the vehicle because there's that compelling moment. And now I want to make that content shareable and searchable so it reaches a whole new generation of listeners and is discovered in just fantastic and exciting new ways.
My experience in a control room is pretty simple. The less I think about the technology, the better off I am, and the better my show is, and the better my performance is.
To lead in our world, it's all about innovation. It's what's that new, next big idea? Anytime we get to take our content and spread it, that helps us create word of mouth, or as it is now, online digital postings and social, that gives us the greatest promotional tool ever. And that's something we're all trying to embrace.
It's, Essentially, radio is a document. It's just a spoken document. But we've considered it all along to be audio. So by transcribing it, that audio becomes searchable and discoverable, not just to audiences, but to us within the radio station. So we can search for, someone said banana yesterday. That's fine. They said it at 17 minutes past 10 in the morning and exactly this many milliseconds. So it's not just accurate transcription, it's time accurate. So now imagine you can edit your entire show just by clicking on the words or the script within the show. That's actually all you're really doing using a waveform editor. It's just that you're having to map between squiggly lines and what was really essentially a spoken performance or the words that happened. So it makes radio searchable, which is fantastic. It makes it fit for sort of closed captioning, which is the way that now people often read Facebook audio before they actually click and hear it. And importantly, it makes it time accurate so that you can do your job just by clicking on the words that you said, whether that's searching for them or using that as an in and out cue to edit. I think we can create an even more intimate environment for radio. We don't want to get rid of all the technology, but we need to smarten it to a point where it becomes less of a distraction. And I think the whole cushions and daylight idea was, can we actually make this more comfortable and natural an environment, not just for the talent and presenters, because we're kind of used to this stuff, but I think when we're interviewing people and we're inviting guests into our space, if we were sitting surrounded by cushions and daylight, I think what we would get out of our guests and the way we appear to our audiences would be transformed. There's nothing wrong with the way we make radio. We want to help you to make it smarter and better and fit for all the devices that we now have to hit. So thanks for giving us your time. We're trying to start what we call the creative conspiracy. That's engineers working with talent in the studio to take technology and help really to improve content and have it do exciting things. So if you want to join the conspiracy, you can see what we're up to. Our website is bionic.radio, or hopefully we'll be in touch to find out how we might be to help you to build a bionic studio for the future. Thanks for listening.
So the things that Dan showed you there, that almost instant transcription, for example, it happens to be done by an outside company. Your audio goes live to an outside company, and within a minute or two, it's back into a file, and you can do touchscreen editing based upon the words that were spoken, or you can spend less money and have it done not quite as quickly. But it's interesting to think about what's possible. And Dan's system there works only with audio over IP systems. In fact, right now his systems only work with Telos gear, but they could possibly work with
one thing is still the same year after year.
Go to the next one. There we go. So, what are some technologies that enable the things that Dan's talking about, or even future? Well, these are all things. Two of them are certainly familiar with voice over IP. And then there's audio over IP, there's intercom over IP, and this new thing, MPX over IP. It's not entirely new, but we got an interesting take on how that could work. Now, voice over IP, I know you're familiar with that. You probably got VoIP phones in your place, but I've got a quick video to, if you haven't gotten the message yet, you can pay for, some fantastic new gear by the savings in voice over IP. Let's roll that video.
Let's examine some actual costs and savings as reported by broadcast engineers in some top 100 U.S. markets.
First is a large commercial cluster in a top 50 market. By moving from ISDN PRI to a managed SIP connection, the stations are saving $900 per month, or over $10,000 per year. Their director of engineering talks about his cluster's telecom savings.
I was paying about $1,500 a month plus usage for a traditional PRI. I now pay $600 a month flat, which includes unlimited local and long-distance calling using a managed SIP trunk. Basically, it's a service provided by the CLEC, or competitive carrier. They manage the traffic entirely on their network as voice over IP. With this managed SIP service for our phones, I'm saving the stations about 60% on their monthly phone bill.
At a community station in that same top 50 market, their engineer brought in SIP trunks at a monthly cost of $150. He installed his own SIP PBX phone system and new SIP desk phones. Had they used legacy POTS phone service, the monthly recurring cost would have been about $400 per month. Savings for this small radio operation, then, is about $250 per month, or $3,000 per year. Another station in a top 75 radio market is using a combination of PRI and SIP connections. The engineer is responsible for cost optimization not only at the main facility, but also at co-owned station clusters in two other markets within the state.
For our business in On Airlines, we've moved away from four bonded T1s for internet and three PRIs for telephone and ISDN, replacing them with just one 30 megabit per second fiber link. We went from 6 megabits per second to 30 megabits per second for about the same money. Now we have 6 megabit per second MPLS circuits to our two other markets. The asterisk PBXs in each market have dial plans that direct market-to-market calls over this MPLS to avoid toll charges. Also, these circuits were much less expensive than having corporate WAN access provided to each market.
Our final example is a station cluster in a top 30 radio market. Their engineer notes that ISDN costs are skyrocketing and notes we should have weaned ourselves off that technology years ago. That's a candid and truthful admission, to be sure. This station cluster is now in high gear planning replacement IP-based service. The sooner they switch to an IP-based telephone service, the sooner their monthly cost will decrease. Right. Let's examine some.
Let's get on from there. Audio over IP. Well, we've been doing this now for a good, I've actually been doing this experimentally 20 years ago, but commercially for about the last 15 years. And we, Steve Church once predicted, hey, someday every device is going to have an Ethernet jack on it. And, you know, nowadays we got transmitters that do. We have microphones that do. We have speakers that do. And, of course, anything that's running an operating system, Linux, Mac, Windows, can have an IP driver in it and connect not only audio, but metadata into the network. And so, you know, in previous years when we had a sound card, right? When we put audio out of that sound card, we would end up losing all the metadata. All we would get was audio. Now, I know we're in the audio business in radio, but nowadays there's so much metadata that we would like to be able to not only preserve, but transport, massage, and put it out into the various places that we need to. So now we have, of course, close to 10,000 Axia consoles around the world, and when you add in audio over IP consoles from other manufacturers, I'm guessing you'd have probably close to 15,000 or more audio over IP consoles running right now. Another benefit of audio over IP is the wiring. This is the second studio that was added to a facility in Nashville, and they ran some backup cabling, but literally one Cat 6 cable connects everything that's audio in and GPIO in this studio to the rest of the system. Literally one cable, and it's not even overtaxed. Audio over IP. You know, of course, probably most of you have dealt with audio codecs, IP codecs. One interesting thing, and it's kind of interesting about, will Telos always be making codecs? We have for years and years, but will we always? At the Sochi Olympics a few years ago in Sochi, Russia, a lot of networks went there, brought their ISDN gear, and they found out the hard way that ISDN wasn't all that reliable or even usable in Sochi, but the IP worked pretty well. So Radio Sweden, they checked this out in advance. They were able to connect to a European media network, kind of like Vivix here in the U.S., I suppose. But it was a new IP network, mostly for professional users, and you had to pay pretty pennies to be part of it. But in Sochi, they got a link to it, and then they connected across Europe. And instead of using audio codecs at Radio Sweden, they just used an Axia X node at each end and sent linear audio, multiple channels of it, from Sochi back to Stockholm. And you know, an Axia X node is half the price of a codec because it doesn't have a lot in there. It's just, you know, converting audio to linear packetized data. So that's a new thing. IOIP, intercom over IP. This is kind of a neat idea. I've got an example right here. I'm going to pass this around. The thing that I'm going to pass around and let you play with or touch, and I do need it back. If I don't return this, it's $1,000 out of my paycheck. But this has a power over Ethernet connection to it. It can also daisy chain to another belt pack with the same power over Ethernet. And then there's a 4-pin XLR here for a standard headset. But you don't have to headset it. It's got a microphone built in and a speaker built in. So you can, you know, a person could actually set this on the desk. You can take the belt clip off. You can clip it nearby. It's got two different talk channels on it. It's got a whole CPU. It's got an ARM processor in here. By the way, if it feels hefty, it's because this whole thing meets every CE and UL spec for safety, for RF containment, for suppression from RF. This can even render several channels of audio. In other words, this is part of a system that doesn't require a central matrix like intercom systems have always required. The job of rendering PL groups, talk, you know, all the different things you have to render that's normally done in a central matrix is distributed and on the fly dynamically from the different devices that are in the network. And even the little diminutive belt pack can do some of that. Greg, I'll pass that to you. It's really cute to plug a PoE power supply in that and see it come up, and it's got a whole operating system. It's as cool as can be. But with intercom over IP, here's a typical system built as we've been building intercoms for years now. But everything in green, everything circled in green, with an IP-based system where you've designed the rendering and the control to be dynamically allocated, everything in green goes away. You don't have to buy it. You just have the endpoints and the network. So a typical system will look like one of these four systems. And because it's natively IP anyway, it's really easy to make this work over a WAN situation. In fact, the panels, the intercom panels, by turning on a license, they have Opus codecs built into them, and you can Opus codec to different locations. So this makes going across the country, across the state, to a truck, it makes all that really easy. I've got a really nice video on our website from a little station, an ABC affiliate in Shreveport, Louisiana, called KTBS, where they implemented this, and the IT guy loves it. The guy in charge of the remote trucks loves it. Of course, the director of engineering loves it because it was his idea to not install anything that didn't connect with a blue cable. So that's intercom over IP. Now, the next thing I want to mention to you is multiplex over IP. Now, this is not entirely a new idea. There are probably three or four other manufacturers in the world that let you put MPX into a box and come out with IP and send that to one or multiple places and come out the other end and turn it back into analog MPX for your FM transmitter. And those systems all take anywhere from about 2 or 2.5 megabits per second on the low end, and that's if you whittle it down to like 12-bit depth, and you're not going to carry an RDS signal. We figured out how to do this and actually use a codec. But it's not an audio codec. It's a different kind of codec. That's it's kind of a secret. I guess I won't be invited to another paycheck if I disclose it. But we can whittle that down to 400 kilobits per second. Now I know what you're thinking, probably as I thought. Well, that's got to sound bad, taking literally 2.5 megabits of data and making that 400 kilobits, and you've got the left plus right, the left minus right, the pilot, the RDS data, but it's very cleverly whittled down to 400 kilobits. And are there artifacts? Yes. But thank goodness it's FM. Because with FM, there's actually some places in the spectrum that we can put trash that doesn't matter. And I say trash, I'm kind of exaggerating here. If you use this codec, it ends up trashing the baseband by 3 or 4 dB, but it's already way, way down anyway. So it really doesn't matter. And it doesn't affect the perceived loudness, the quality. It doesn't affect the peak control at all because the codec is not working on the audio, per se. So anyway, we can do this multiplex over IP at 400 kilobits. Well, this opens up some interesting possibilities. At my radio stations in Mississippi, we're sending linear live wire from the studio to the transmitter site over an IP link. Well, that requires not only 2.5 megabits per stereo pair, right? And we put the processors all at the transmitter site. But the quality of that data transmission has got to be just perfect. I mean, LiveWire and other AOIP models like AES-67, Ravenna, those were meant to go over a piece of wire. And so packet loss is not part of the equation that they can deal with. So our IP link has got to work really perfectly. Well, when you go to a system like this, you have a little bit of grace that first of all, you can buffer more. You can let the IP radios handle retransmission of packets if they need to, because you're buffering at the far end, and let the radios reassemble that. You could also use public internet as maybe a main, or more probably a backup. So at this transmitter side I'm talking about, we've got the IP radio, but we've also got wireless ISP as a backup. Now, we only got 6 megabits per second down, but I've got 3 FMs now and 400 kilobits per second east. That's, you know, well under 1.5 megabits that I can send backup audio to the transmitter site, or even main if I trust it well enough. So the point here is that you can take, Omnia has a couple of processors for which this bit rate reduced MPX, it's called micro MPX, is an option. So you don't even need a separate box at the studio. You can come out of one of our processors that's got micro MPX as an option and feed that right into internet or an IP link, whether it's public internet or a private WAN or an IP radio, and then decode it with a physical box at the transmitter site. An example, of course, over some kind of radio link, and it doesn't have to be perfect like it does for LiveWire or other linear AOIP. And another example would be, hey, you could fit 5 FMs on 2 megabits worth of bandwidth. So that might be an interesting possibility to get that done. As I mentioned, you could use that for a main, or you could use it for a backup. I did a test, by the way. Can you back the slide up one? Is that possible? I did a test. I'd just love to describe this to you. I wanted to try this out, and Telos just had a prototype of the decoder for me. That's all I had to work with. And so I was in Mississippi at my radio station. So I thought, now, okay, I don't have an encoder, not here. So how am I going to listen to this? Oh, I know what. Okay, so my automation system was already on AOIP, on LiveWire. And I had a stream encoder running. I had a zip stream on a PC. And so I thought, I'll make a really, really high quality stream. So I made a 384 kilobit per second AAC stream. At my house in Nashville, 7-hour drive away, I had an audio processor called Omnia SST. And I had that running on a little Windows PC. So I remoted into that PC, and I brought up, VLC, right, to pick up a stream and play it into that PC. So I picked up that stream I had just made, played it into that PC, directed its output over to the input of the Omnia SST FM audio processor running in that same little cheap PC, turned on the micro MPX, turned around. Now, this is in Nashville. And said, pointed it at the IP address of the station I was at in Cleveland, Mississippi, opened a port in the router, pointed that toward the micro MPX node that I had, and still wasn't done. I wasn't at the transmitter site, but I did have an analog STL, a 950 megahertz cheap, like a Nikon STL. And so I came out of the MPX box and into the STL, put all that on the air. So I'm going from a Linux playout machine, streaming it to Nashville processing it for FM, full baseband, just great processing, sending it that back 400 kilobits per second, putting it into an STL out to the transmitter site, listen to it for about 24 hours. We had never sounded better. Now, I'm comparing it with an old Omnia 3 that we're using, which was great, in 2008, but, this Omnia SST was a bit better. So my point is, I tried this, I was delighted with it, and I can't wait to use it on more of my stations, just as an experiment, and we're starting to ship those things, like, any day. So, disruptive technologies, as we've been talking about, those bring about enabling technologies, and the enabling technologies would be, where are we going with all this IP stuff? IP just gives us a really convenient and universal way to connect things together and deal with the data. Well, I think I probably showed this last year. You know, I've got a PC at one of my stations that just does a lot of stuff. So I've got 5 silent sensors here, and I've got about 7 or 8... stream encoders, and each of those stream encoders is running either Omnia 3 or Omnia 9 processing. So there's a lot going on in this box, and the CPU is still well under 40%, I believe. Here's the audio processor I mentioned ago that I was running at my house. Actually, this one screenshot is from my house, the Omnia SST processor. And here is the encoder, the micro MPX encoder. So it's encoding the left plus right, left minus right, you know, the whole stereo baseband and the RDS. I can tell you one thing. So, you know, think about that. Sampling the RDS part of the signal at, 50? Is that 57 kilohertz? Or is it 53? What is it? 57? Sampling that would take more bits than it's worth. So one of the secrets of micro MPX is we actually decode that into serial data and send that along and then just remake it, because it ain't hard to remake at the other end. So we actually don't sample that, but we turn it into its actual bits and remake that in the decoder box. But that was my setup for Cleveland, Mississippi, testing that out. But if you've noticed the proliferation of PCs at your broadcast facility, well, I sure have, and that represents a weak link. It does for me. I mean, I'm part owner of 14 really small radio stations. And we've got 10 in Mississippi and 1 in Hawaii and 3 more in American Samoa. Well, you sure notice that you need every PC, and we don't have the money for lots of backup systems. So if the power supply died on a little Dell desktop that was running Rivendell, well, guess what? That station's off the air. And if a fan dies, and you know, a Dell desktop has just exactly the number of fans it needs, not always quite enough, well, that computer's not going to run anymore. And the same thing for the hard drives. We wanted to get on the air cheap, so I bought a bunch of off-lease Dell desktops. I actually bought them at Walmart.com, and they were refurbished. They were clean, but they were not new. And so, you know, we'd get 2.5-3 years of life out of a hard drive, and then all of a sudden we had another station off the air, and it was a scramble to, you know, go reinstate a radio station. So that's not a great long-term solution, and a lot of you may have experienced the same kind of thing. So the solution, obviously, is to move into where you have where you're virtualizing the platform as well, and you can use much better hardware. Me, in small radio stations, I wasn't even familiar with server-grade hardware. And a lot of you are going, well, I've been doing that for, you know, a dozen years or more. I wasn't familiar with it. I didn't know how good that stuff was. And though it's not perfect, you got 17 fans in a server, guess what? 2 or 3 of them can belly up, and you can still run the server. The other fans will speed up a little bit, but you're going to be fine until you get that replaced. Two power supplies is really standard, and you plug one into, two different breaker circuits, and you got some better reliability there. So the idea here is to virtualize, you know, run a hypervisor, and now there's even some better ways to do this with Docker technology. But do this, and so you spend more money on the hardware, but you get to use it more efficiently and more fully. You can really plan what goes into it. So here's just a screenshot. Now, not all of these are running on the same server, but this is at my house. I remoted into lots of different stuff. Some of this is on the same machine. And different OSs running on the same machine, physical machine. We have a weird situation. Our IT guy, we're not exactly sure where he lives. We think he's in Brazil. There's a whole story, but I'd have to probably have a beer to tell you the whole story, and you couldn't tell anybody else. But our IT guy is he remotes in when we need him, and he was doing a little because he's been trying to get us to go to this virtualization scheme for a while. So we bought some off-lease servers. I think we spent $800 per Dell R720 server, and bought some nice new hard drives. Everything's rated. There's an external NAS that's all rated that holds all the songs and databases. He did a calculation on how much money we're now spending on electricity per station. Turns out, per radio station for the automation and all the ingest, and we do automatic ingest and automatic file fix up when agencies send us files. Our salespeople can produce spots at their desk. They can, and the ingest system will fix the format of the, if they type Wednesday incorrectly, it'll fix that. For example, we ingest the John Tesh show daily. For example, we ingest all kinds of weekend shows like Dick Bartley, Rock, Roll, and Remember. We ingest all that file fix up, and it all works. Bottom line is, each station electricity bill for all I just described is $1.90 per month. That's pretty freaking amazing. I didn't believe it till I did the math myself, and it actually worked out to $1.90 per month. So, this is an Alex Hartman picture here. Now, you didn't see this in my presentation. This is experimental. Telos doesn't sell this yet. But here's 30 radio stations and 18 rack units, all of it's live wire AOIP. It connects to an Axia Fusion console anywhere on the premises. They've got a couple of those in different rooms. And so, you know, an operator can take control of any of the 30 radio stations. And did I mention it's experimental? This was not exactly done with our blessing, but a little wink and a nod. Let's roll this last video.
Vinyl for Me is about a clever and value-for-money way of guaranteeing BBC local radio in the future.
For us as a team, vinyl will mean an even closer relationship with our audience.
Vinyl's about giving BBC local radio the equipment that it needs to make the best programmes possible.
BBC Three Counties Radio, back to the Aces now. Elton John, I'm Still Standing.
The BBC local radio service is an extensive one, 41 broadcast centres across England, broadcasting around the clock. Some of our local radio stations now have technology that is more than 25 years old, and frankly, it's becoming unreliable, and that's a real worry for me because our local radio stations have a special responsibility to broadcast in times of emergency. What Vylor will give us is a way of refreshing all of those technologies station by station at once without the individual cost mounting up by doing repeated refreshments site by site. And it will also deliver a much more energy efficient solution.
So what is Vylor? It's virtual local radio, and I'm standing in front of it. This is one of the two engine rooms that's going to power local radio into the future. This is in Birmingham, the other one's in London. In the stations, we're going to remove several hundred bays of ancient kit, and instead in the studios you'll have software and control surfaces that will remotely control the equipment behind me. Along the way we've done a pilot in Radio Northampton. We used it on air for about 165 hours with no major on-air incidents, so we know it works.
So what we have here is a three column design. You've got phone lines coming in and out, so this is all the telephony for the studio areas.
Our audience here in Northamptonshire, like audiences everywhere, are increasingly finding new and different ways to communicate with us and to share things with us. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, Skype, as well as all of the other phone calls, emails, everything that we've traditionally used. And what this means is we'll have all of those things in one place for our producers and presenters to use.
The great thing about Vylor is that it's designed by local radio people for local radio people. So right from the outset, local radio presenters, local radio engineers have been involved in the planning, the design, the concept of Vylor. And all through the testing phase, we've involved presenters. They've given their opinions. They've changed things. So by the end, we've got something that really works, that for the first time ever is designed by English regions for local radio.
Northamptonshire Travel.
BBC Radio Northampton.
Yeah, lovely. Can I get your name? Can I say Hawthorne?
I don't really know what hellebores are.
Vylor is a complex and challenging project to deliver. I'm really proud of the team here in Birmingham, particularly for the level of innovation that they've managed to deliver successfully, but also for the way they have run a complex set of relationships. First of all, with the 1,000-plus staff, who all have views on what they might need from their local radio station in the future, but also for the way they've successfully delivered quite a complex web of relationships, both inside the BBC and with the outside suppliers.
The Vylor project is a unique project and something that I've never heard of being achieved anywhere else in the world. The BBC have taken an approach where they've been working with suppliers, best in breed suppliers. They've collaborated with those suppliers to take existing product, to develop that product, to make it work for the Vylor project.
And when we piloted it here at BBC Radio Northampton, our audience, unprompted, got in contact with us to tell us they'd noticed an improvement in the quality of our sound.
Hello, welcome to BBC Essex. This is Louise Briley, and it's the...
It's a guaranteed future for BBC local radio. It's a future which is more efficient in terms of the way we spend the BBC's money and resources, and it's about delivering a new technology that I think will set a standard for the rest of the world.
For us as a team, what Vylor will mean is we have exactly what we need to have an even closer relationship with our audience.
Vylor's about making sure that BBC Local Radio has the best kit, the best equipment to make the best programmes possible.
So I'll show you that just to show you kind of what's possible. Let's get, I'm out of time, so let's just hit a couple of last things. Here are the refitted studios. One of them connects to Birmingham, one connects to London. And they can have a failure at either place, and they just use the studio that still works. So where are we going with virtualization, and where are we now? Well, for example, Telos offers a product called Pathfinder Core Pro. Today, you can buy this as an appliance, or you can buy it as a virtual machine. Either way, you want to provide the hardware. And by the way, if you buy it as an appliance, a few years from now, when the appliance dies, well, the appliance died. Just like when your toaster dies, you got to buy a new one. If you buy the virtual machine, well, if your hardware dies, you still have the license you bought, and you can install it in something else. So it's an interesting concept that if you buy software, and most software you have to pay a service, an SLA, a service level agreement, or maybe a subscription model, but you kind of get to keep your investment. What if your EAS could be virtualized? I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying, hey, DASDEC runs on a PC inside their box anyway. Why not do that? Today, you can go to radio.co, and in a couple hours from now, you can have a radio station on the web. Now, it doesn't have EAS. It doesn't have FM processing. You can do basic voice tracking with it. You can upload your voice tracks, but you can do that today. What if you could do that for your radio station and you had access to your network news and all the ingest that you might normally do? And then what if you could send that from a data center or your own data center or cloud to your transmitter site with micro MPX? And what if your talent that wanted to could work from home? Well, a lot of people are doing that kind of thing now, but we're going to reach that point where it's going to be really, really possible. I can't wait for the day that my stations can pay, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000 a month, and I don't have any racks of gear at my station anymore. I can do what BBC did and go from 12 racks of gear at every local station down to about 2 racks of gear. So, thanks for your time. I appreciate your attention, and I'm not sure what we're selling, but I want you to think bigger about what the future can hold and how it can be really convenient for you to set up. Thanks.